As pastor, I have the wonderful opportunity to preach at the earlier 8:45 contemporary service as well as our traditional 11 o'clock service. And so I have to sometimes write two different messages because I have to hurry up today at 11. And I was able to preach a little bit more. So y'all be waving your clocks at me if I start getting long because I've slipped into the 8:45 mode. But I'm excited about confirmation. You must understand, and I've told our confirmation class this, and Nick heard it on our confirmation retreat, that when I grew up in Pine Forest United Methodist Church, somewhere in my early years, they decided that the crop of kids were ready for confirmation, and I went with the preacher and a bunch of other kids, and we sat in the choir room, and he taught us some classes, and after that was over, we stood up at the end in front of the congregation, and we said some words, and we sat down. And I have no clue what it was all about. I was just doing what I was told. Did I want to join the church? Oh, yeah, sure, sounds good. We go to it anyway, might as well. I'm 12 or whatever. And that's so sad because I've got friends who are of other denominations, a lot of Baptist and congregational-type churches, and they don't do it the way we do it when it comes to introducing the gospel to their kids. They say, well, when it happens, it happens. We're a good church, and we preach the gospel every Sunday, and they're going to get it. Well, nowadays, kids don't come every Sunday. It's hard to get them to come once a month in some families because of the way their schedules are, or staying with mom in this city and dad in this city. This past week, we're in North Carolina, and we're buying some gift things for the confirmands and the graduates. And Paula says, well, I'll volunteer to go shopping, which I'm very grateful for. Where'd you go, dear? There she is. Thank you. And she says she went to the Christian bookstore in Goldsboro, North Carolina, where I grew up and where we were visiting. And she says, I'm looking for some gift bags. You know, do you have anything like for confirmation? And the lady said, what? What's that? And she tried to explain, and the more she talked, the more confused the lady got. It was a Baptist bookstore, okay? But there are those who don't do confirmation, don't understand it. And what I love about confirmation is the fact that we as a church, not the pastor, but we as a church say, we're going to gather together all of our younger kids before they get too tied up in sports, before they get too caught up in all these other things, and say, we're going to be the gospel to you for a period of time. I looked at a bulletin recently of a church in Ohio, and they have confirmation for 2 years. We had how many weeks? Like 11 weeks or something like that. But I don't know that it's the amount of time we spend in it, but the amount of quality time that we spend. And so as we've done this over the past 11 weeks or so, and five young people associated with this church, most of whom grew up and were baptized right here in this church, have had a chance to say, I get what you're saying. I've been to Sunday school. And yes, I'm ready to profess Jesus Christ as my Savior and put my whole trust in His grace and promise to serve Him as my Lord in union with the church which Christ has given to all ages, nations, and races. Something like that. We'll be saying those words. They join Christ's church. And they identify with this congregation, Grace Church, you, us. And that's a beautiful thing. Church is shrinking. You know why? Because the old folks are dying and the younger folks drift away. It's as simple as that. Most churches are shrinking. Christianity as a whole in the developed world is shrinking rapidly. Because, why? The old folks what? It helps you to get over your fear of death if you say that. The old folks and the young folks drift away. But if we can invest ourselves in our young folks and do confirmation more like it should be and not like it was for me, then we can reverse one side of that. The other side we can't change. And so one of the ways to do that is to kind of think about where we as a body, where we as a church, have that old guard mentality we talked about last week. that old guard that tries to keep the status quo and doesn't like a lot of change or comfort. Because if anything, Carrie Frost's world is way different than her grandfather's. How many people were in your graduating class?
600.
Well, that's a bad example. I thought you were going to say like 50. Wow. Okay. You get the point? I should have cleared that with John. 43 in France. Okay, we'll go with Francis. 43 in her graduating class. And if you're going to go to Warwick, 300-400 probably. Technology. How many cell phones were with your first, with your graduating class?
No cell phones.
Mm-hmm. There was no internet porn. There was no internet gambling. And I'm not saying the internet is bad. I'm just saying their world is so much different and there's a generation gap that is huge. But we can overcome generation gaps, not just with education, but with relationship. And that comes in the form, I think, of mentoring. Us really as adults saying, I want to reach out to a kid or some kids and invite them to be in a relationship with me and just, you know, let them know I'm interested in that we can talk about faith. So when we do this, we turn to the scriptures from Titus today, where Paul writes to Titus, and it's a very interesting relationship he has with him. What we know about Titus, if we're to do a character study, is the fact that he was a Gentile Christian, not a Jewish Christian, probably from the area of Antioch. And when Paul first got his marching orders from God and he went out and went on that first missionary journey, it's likely that he met Titus and Titus became a follower of Jesus and they continued the relationship and he brought him up under his wing, much like he did the other one we talk about a lot, Timothy. And so he brought Titus up under his wing and became a mentor to him. And he was so trusted by Paul. Paul gave him all the really hard jobs. Like when the Corinthian church was needing some correction, Paul wrote his letters to the Corinthians. And by the way, if you don't see many churches like, you know, First Corinthian Church of Newport News or, you know, Corinth this or whatever, because the Corinthian church was the dysfunctional one. That's why Paul wrote so many letters to them, because they were all messed up. And so he was always writing letters, and he sent Titus with the letter and to be that ambassador, to be there helping guide them on his behalf. So he gave him that hard job. And then later, he and Titus and others and his entourage are going through the area on another missionary journey. They get to the island of Crete, and Paul says, I need to keep on going, but Titus, I want you to stay here. Have you ever, especially if you've been around a while, used to, when somebody did something wrong or you didn't think very highly of them, you say, look at that cretin. You ever remember calling somebody or hearing somebody called a cretin? I always thought that meant somebody who was vulgar or gross. But that's not what it meant back then. The island of Crete had a reputation. They were so materialistic. They didn't care how or where you got your money. If you had money, you were highly esteemed, and they don't care how you got it. So that smugglers and pirates had refuge in their harbor, and the authorities wouldn't come get them. The people in Crete would hide them. And there was a poet back then who actually wrote this about Crete. He said he was talking about Zeus, and they didn't think Zeus was divine, and he did. And he said, they fashioned a tomb for thee, O Zeus. The Cretans, always liars, evil beasts, and idle bellies, they're not, but thou art not dead, thou livest and abidest forever. And Paul heard some of the writings of this poet, and he quoted a different poem by this poet in Titus chapter 1. And this is the quote. Now, Paul's not saying this about him, he's just quoting somebody else. Cretans are always liars, evil brutes, and lazy gluttons. They care more about money. Another guy wrote in the second century, Polybius, said that greed and avarice are so native to the soil of Crete, and Cretans, by their ingrained avarice, are engaged in countless public and private seditions, murders, and civil wars. They were so greedy that it disrupted families and society, caused people to kill people. You can look at the news and you'll see that that happens even still today. So Paul moves on to preach something, you know, to other places, and he decides to leave Titus behind. Who better? Who better to leave in a place like Crete where your smugglers and pirates find harbor than your most trusted friend, than your brightest student? Who better to leave behind than your true son in the common faith? That's what he called him in Titus chapter 1. He says, to Titus, my true son in the common faith. As he had begun mentoring him, as he took him under his wing, he developed a relationship much like a father and a son would, to the point where he calls him literally my true son. He's not just a friend. He's not just a student. My true son. So you, adults in Grace Church, I'm speaking to the adults, who will be our true sons and daughters? Who will we be leaving our future to? Who will we be leaving our church and our community? Who are our young friends? Who are our most trusted and brightest students? Who are our sons and daughters in the common faith? I'll tell you who they are. I'm going to give you a nice little litany of who they are. Calypso Alajabu, Adam Brackman, Kelsey Lewis, and Krista Lewis, even though they're members at Oak Grove, UMC, and Chesapeake, but they are a part of this worshiping community as they're here in college. Ben Teague, Brooke Kempa, Carrie Frost, Chad Lentz, Barrett McFall, Porter McFall, Philip Michael Burke, Baker McFall, Hannah Jack and Emily Robinson. You want me to keep going? Because I am. Samantha Jackson, Johnny O'Neill and Austin Capps, Glenda Nightingale, Madison Ella Caldwell, Camellia Natalie Monge, Adley Rivera, Chelsea and Mallory Simonson, Eva Lilienthal, Max Bell, Braylon Gray, McKinley and Lochner Lamb, Grayson McCarthy, Layla Migas, Casey and Mary Randall, and Cash and Juliet Rogers. Oh, you heard your names called. My friends, I just read to you 29 names of real people, from young adult exiting college all the way down to just graduating from infancy, who are members, who are a part of, who are connected to this faith community called Grace UMC. They are supposed to be our true sons and daughters. And so I ask you, are they being mentored as Paul mentor Titus?
Lay it on
him. Thank you, John. Do you see in them, as Paul did in him, their potential to change the world? If you do, then you would say, sure, I can see a 14-year-old on church council. Oh, oops. That's a little more difficult. Their potential to change the world, even at an early age, wherever they are in life and their spiritual development, are you ready to entrust them, to them, the ministries of the church? Are you willing to share with them the ministries of this church? Are you willing to see the future of this church, this community, this world in their hands? Now, I think if you've really tried to answer those questions in your head, sometimes you're going, yeah, oh, sure I do. Not so sure about that question. That one, yes. That one, no. How do we ensure that we say yes, 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 yes? We can do no better than look at what Paul tells Titus when he leaves him with that crazy church in Crete. He tells the older ones to become wise guides. In the first four verses, there's a lot of stuff about what old men are supposed to do, how they're supposed to be. And for the interest of time, I'm going to summarize all that and just say that the old men and the older ladies are to become wise guides. What would happen if the old guard, and I know there's very little of that here at Grace Church, but see, usually you have the old guard and you have the people who go either way. We don't really care. You know, we're just along for the ride. What if all the people who are along for the ride said, we want to be wise guides to the younger folks of our church so that we can impart wisdom? In this case, he says the old men have to be self-controlled and serious, sensible. And I love this. It almost sounds like he's going back. Paul's talking about 1 Corinthians chapter 13, the love chapter. He says, so that their faith, love, and patience must never fail. Never failing love. Guys, if you're over the age of 30, you should be hearing me now. Your never failing love, your never failing faith, and as macho men, we don't go around talking about our faith to other guys, especially younger ones. We've got to overcome that. Your never failing patience, because they're going to look at you like you're a weirdo. But you be patient. You can change the world by changing them. Tell the older women, Paul says, to behave as those who love the Lord should. Whatever that means. Oh, this is what it means. They must not gossip about others or be slaves to wine. Ladies, stop watching Housewives of Atlanta, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Because that's all they do anyway. I see the commercials. I know what they talk about. They must teach what is proper so that younger women will be loving wives and mothers. They must teach what is proper. So isn't it good for men to guide the younger guys and ladies to guide the younger ladies? And I think we're going to pick on Frances again. She could stand up here at this microphone and teach you everything she's ever learned about her faith. But if you're not listening or you don't know who she is or you don't trust her, it does no good. But if Frances befriended Amy and found out they had similarities in life and they did life together, a life of faith, one generation has a lot to share with the next generation. And the whole goal is not to just impart wisdom, but it says so that they can, where is it? So that younger women will be loving wives and mothers. In other words, when people look on the outside and they see the culture of the church, it's not that the housewives of Atlanta going on in the church. We're different. And so, elders set the right example, seeking out, teaching, and inviting others to be in that relationship. Now, there's another part, and that's the wise orphans. You heard me mention orphans before in the children's sermon. There was, in the list that I selected those names from, about 68 different movie characters, a lot of Disney characters, that were orphans. And the person that wrote the book says, well, why? Why do so many heroes from children's books become, why do they start out as orphans? Because children identify with that kind of abandonment, especially today. Children feel like, as a general rule, that society has abandoned them. And it's not just out there, it's even in here. That's why children are drifting away as they grow. So a wise thing to do would be for us and the youngers, if you're below the age of 30, to say, like an orphan, like Simba, I have great potential. God can do great things. I can be a hero. But I know that beyond just my father and my mother, if they're still a part of my life, I need a wise guide. It takes some humility. Most of the time when we're little, we and young adults, how many of you ever said, no, I don't want to hear what you said anymore, Mom and Dad. I am 18 and I know what I'm doing and let me make my own mistakes. Or maybe you can change age to 12. I don't know. But it takes some humility to say, they've got some wisdom. The older I get, the smarter my parents appear, right? They made some really smart decisions when I thought they were stupid. And they still do make some really smart decisions. And so learning to listen to and not just let it flow out the other ear. So a wise orphan is one who listens and is willing to be mentored. I think when we're at annual conference next week, you get the wonderful privilege of hearing Kim Rumsey preach. After her years as an Episcopal priest, I don't know how often it's been. She's preached here in quite a few years, but I think she's going to go on the line of daddies and families. I don't want to steal all her thunder, but what if we became the family of God that Paul talks about? He says, we're not just strangers, and we're not just orphans. We are the adopted family of God. So Bob comes from one background, I come from another, Leanne comes from another, and Cheryl comes from another. But we're all each in some way an orphan, and we've been adopted into God's family. And as that, we can all be heroes. What would it look like? Every day is a new possibility. I'm going to close with a story I'm reading. I don't like to read up front in a message, but I cannot tell the story like Scott Wilcher can. Scott is a pastor down in Chesapeake, a speaker, a consultant in youth ministry. He's done it for like 30 years. He wrote a book. Might be the next one we do in church council. It's called The Orphan Generation. Here's the story. Mr. Harding's seat was taken. It's the aisle seat on the seventh pew from the front on the right side. It was his seat nearly every Sunday for over 30 years. The pew where he'd sat with his wife and then with his kids. But his kids, they've grown up. They moved away. And since his wife has died 3 years ago, he sat there alone. Over those 30 years, Mr. Harding watched the church change. The faces, they changed. The service changed. The music changed. The pastor changed. Everything changed. Except his seat. So now he stood in the center aisle beside the seventh pew, right side, trying to figure out what to do about that dark-haired kid who was sitting slumped over in his seat. David. David had come to church looking for his friend and some food. The friend was a classmate who had invited him to come to this church, but it was several weeks ago. He assured David that he was welcome at any time and that there would always be free donuts and muffins. David had blown off the invitation, but after last night, he reconsidered. David's stepfather had come home drunk again. And the shouting started, and David knew better than to get involved, so he left. He spent the night on a neighbor's deck in a padded lounge chair, sleeping a little, but mostly just looking at the stars and wondering. So he showed up. He walked to church, and an older gentleman showed him where the donuts were and even poured him a cup of weak coffee that looked like tea. David stood beside that table alone and ate two donuts and watched the people arrive. They were mostly older folks, but they seemed harmless enough. David had been to church, you see, for several weddings and a couple of funerals. And he decided to stay for the service, hoping to see his friend from school, but also very curious. Because, see, there were two men in dark suits guarding the doors. Those two men, one was talking about his vacation plans, and the other just listened and nodded. When David slipped in between them, the silent man just handed him a program and kept nodding. And the older man just kept talking. David moved up the center aisle, and at the seventh pew, from the front, right side, he sat down. A few minutes later, David became aware that someone was standing in the aisle. And he turned, and an old man was looking down at him. In one hand, the man held a program in front of himself like a shield. And with his other hand, he kept patting his lips nervously. Looking at him, David saw that his face seemed sad, but in his eyes, David recognized disapproval. He had seen that many times before. David turned back toward the front and ignored him for as long as he could. Finally, he could not stand it any longer, and he turned around and said, "Can I help you?" with a little too much meanness than he intended. That's my seat," the old man said flatly. David grunted, slid wearily to his right, regretting that he even came here at all. Mr. Harding claimed his seat, and the two of them sat, only a few feet apart. But that gap was huge. They both sat silently, a lonely older man beside a frightened teen, both of them blind to the glorious opportunity orchestrated just for them and for that church. To God be the glory. Amen.